I'm here with Michael David Arion, and I am Diane Quinn, and we're here doing interview 2 of 3 in November, on November 6th, Saturday, in Michael's apartment in New York City for the Actors Fund. Michael, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your education and training, as far as how it compares to what you think younger actors today are working on. So you've talked about studying with the Academy and so forth. Can you take me through that and then talk about maybe some actors in your life that you know about their training?
Well, when I came to the Academy, I was here on a scholarship, and I sort of had to take whatever they threw at me. In other words, I didn't choose the curriculum or any of my classes or teachers. And I got an interesting mix of teachers, and they all had their own style. The classes were kind of antique in a way, because none of them were up to what was really going on in the theater world in those days. They were still dwelling on Catherine Cornell and the Lunts and such, and Hair had just come out. A lot of modern theater changing shows were either had opened or were going to open, and they weren't in the mix with the real world, so they really didn't know. And those of us, me and my fellow students, couldn't make them understand how to get in the swing of things. The only couple of things they did that I appreciated were we had fencing, we did some movement classes, and I learned how to take snuff in a very theatrical way. And the music teacher taught us, didn't teach us, but required us to have a audition-ready song every single week we were there. So that worked really nice. One of the main differences I see in young actors today as opposed to when I was starting out was in my time, sometimes there'd be the bonus of an actor who could play an instrument or had a special skill or something that would go under a heading on the resume that said special skills. Now, I don't know if it's just my imagination, but actors can do things that I'd never heard of learning, circus skills and tumbling and double and triple and quadruple on musical instruments and dance and sing and act up a storm, especially if you look at what's on Broadway now, some of the musicals, they are tour de force for 30 and 40 people. It's quite astounding. But other than that, it seems like, I don't know, it seems like they're younger. On stage, they're younger than they used to be. So it's something about stamina or knowing the right people. I'm not real sure.
Okay. And what would you say your criteria for success was? What it was then and how you look at criteria for success now? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the one thing I aimed for was if I thought I would have a good time doing whatever show I was offered. And I don't think I ever got anything from an audition other than being known for always singing Alexander's Ragtime Band, the pianists that I would see over and over, they all knew what to do. The people that did the auditions, the casting people, they all knew me, and they'd laugh and, oh, welcome, how are you doing? And I also got to know a lot of people I would be auditioning with. So, what else? What else did you ask?
The criteria for success.
For success, it was would I have a good time, mm-hmm. and I only got recommended for shows by people that knew me. I knew a lot of directors. I got my job at the Public Theater through my friend that composed the music for the show, and he recommended me to the director, who also knew me and knew my work, and kind of slapped his forehead and said, "Oh, why didn't I think of him?" And just hired me. And the first union show I did, I had auditioned quite a few times, and I did not make it. And I was in a show, and the production people came to see it. And the next morning, I was awakened to them on the phone saying to come in. And basically, they said to sign a contract, which is what I did. And I don't go up for shows anymore, but I still try to have at least a comfortable time, if not a good time.
Okay. And you were talking about, it seems to me, the networking, your process of networking. You said knowing people. Do you do any networking today, even though you're not working on shows? Do you do any networking, acting or theater related, now in your life today?
No, not really. I only speak to a couple of friends on the phone, so there's really no networking involved. I see in the capacity of my job, I'm basically a doorman in a rehearsal building, and so my networking is often 10 to 20 strangers a day. And I'll get to know them depending on the schedule, how consistently they rehearse in my building. But that's the extent of my networking now.
And are the people that are coming to that building rehearsing for a show that is going to be part of La Mama's show, or is it open?
Mostly it is, yeah. But we've had other groups from other places, and we've had a holding for films and such, so there's been a variety of people in there.
Okay. And La Mama was, as you described it, a very big portion of your career. Can you talk about the people in that situation that you perhaps worked with more than once and how that evolved?
I was brought to see a show at La Mama in about 1968. And it was a group called the Playhouse of the Ridiculous, directed by John Vaccaro. And I thought it was the funniest thing ever. And I really wanted to work with them. I thought it would be a great idea. So I soon got to meet Ellen Stewart, who actually took me by the hand to introduce me to John. She took me up the street to Phoebe's, where they were, after a show, and sat me down with him and introduced me, and I got to know him a little. So I was in the next show he did. And what else did you ask?
Was it like a family atmosphere, or was it, because you worked with these same people, I'm gathering, over time?
Yes, I worked with a core of people in his company for over 18 years. And many of them, maybe, or somewhere around and under a dozen, stayed with them the whole time. And we went to 4 tours of Europe. We did, I should count, maybe a dozen shows, probably a little less. But people, we were very popular, and we had a following, and I even had a couple of groupies, and we got to know our audience very well. So opening night was a truly great experience. It was a lot of fun all around.
Can you tell me a little bit about how it was for you working within that group of people that you knew so well?
Well, you knew who to trust on stage, who you could falter near, then they could help you save yourself or the scene or the action or whatever you were faltering with, and you knew who you couldn't trust. There were people that I knew never to come near on a stage because they would, just out of their dumbness and their lack of understanding of space, would as soon hit you or flail, and you would get hit accidentally or on purpose, whatever it would be. You learned. I learned who I couldn't come near. And it was always good, because we functioned like a really well-oiled machine, because our director absolutely had a style of his own, and something called the Playhouse of the Ridiculous, you have to understand, would be the craziest version of whatever we did. And Extreme Stereotype was every character we did. And, goodness, and it was fun. It was really great fun. And we would do what he said at rehearsal, because he did a lot of screaming and jumping around. And then we'd often get together and talk about what we just experienced and how wrong his choices were, and continue to do what he said while he was there. And then come opening night, we would do what we thought was the right thing to do, which we had discussed already, and he never ever called us on it. I don't know if he just stopped paying attention or saw that we had solved the problem that he had created. But he had a style all his own, and I just have to take off my hat to the man who, and he has just recently passed on, and I really have to give him a tip of the hat and thank him for the hard work he did inventing this whole thing.
And so when you worked with him, how did you feel? Can you talk about that as far as working with him directly? I don't mean the rest of the cast. If you were doing a scene with him, can you talk about how that would unfold?
Well, when I joined his company, I was the first union actor he'd ever hired. Most of his company, in fact, all of his company, were famous for having been picked off the street, are found in Max's Kansas City, or just drunkenly wandered in the door. And I was the first one with any kind of training. Not that he called on it, because he didn't have any real theater background. He was a real high intellectual. He was a very, very bright man, and very musical. And we never had to really work one-on-one together. We never actually did. But these were the days where the preparation for the show was to smoke a big fat joint and to go on and have a good time. And that is exactly what I found myself doing every performance.
But the shows were scripted and there were songs that were given to you. So it wasn't improv.
No, never.
Okay.
I mean, we would get carried away and improvise something on the stage, but you know, knowing everybody in all the departments, like if it was a musical and I had songs, it was my job to know the conductor or pianist, the sound man, and the spotlight people. Because you didn't want to be in the dark and not heard with the wrong key. And it was easy to do that because they were always my friends. I always liked the tech people for just those reasons.
And did you spend time with them beyond rehearsals?
Oh, yeah. Oftentimes, I lived with one or more of the my fellow actors. And of course, when we went on tour, we shared hotel rooms, and we were always going out to dinner or just getting together over a weekend and just having a good time.
And did any of those actors help you, or did you help them go on to the next show if it was not part of this company?
I'm not sure what you mean, but yeah, we did, because we stayed friendly between shows. So that would be a help, because who wants to be friendless in this cold, cold world?
Very true. So can you talk a little bit about the place, the physical place of La Mama, and since that's, and you know, where you worked? Can you tell me a little bit about that back in when you were working in it?
Well, Ellen Seward always talks about the first time she walked in the building that they now possess at 74 East 4th. She said you walked in the front door and there was no floor, and you could see all the way to the sky. And she was able, and there are documentaries of her describing how it came about, but she was very early with getting Ford Foundation grants, and I don't even know, she was just such a wheeler dealer and was so good at squeezing money out of people, and somehow got to know a lot of wealthy people and got a lot done. And she put the building together the way that she wanted it. She had no training in the theater either and picked everything up along the way. So after 50 years doing this, she was the supreme voice of anything you needed to ask her. She had done so many Greek myths and stories and legends that she was called on by people from all over the place to give her opinion of certain things. But she never really knew about staging and things that actors have to do to keep being seen, like countering someone else's move and such. But she counted on us and the quality of her actors to be able to fill in the blanks, just like John did with the Playhouse. So she learned as we could teach her.
Okay. And did you ever, did you ever have a creative block or something when either working on those pieces or when you're touring, or something that you had a block and then gone past it? Have you ever had that experience?
No.
No?
No. And it sort of wouldn't have been the case, because when we played in New York, it was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday for a month or two, or on rare occasions longer. So you never had time to get bored to create a block. And we weren't doing anything, at least I wasn't, beyond the creative that I needed to get on stage every night. So there was nothing to block. It was all just running on your gut, if you will.
Okay. And what were some of your biggest challenges in working with those people?
Well, the people weren't the challenge. It was the roles. I played a couple of very, I want to say questionable roles, but I was a character actor, so I played a two-year-old baby girl and was just beaten and walloped from one side of the stage to the other, and my ear was pulled so hard one night I couldn't hear for the rest of the evening. And another piece I did, I played Quasimodo, And I decided to go full out, and I wore kind of a wooden-soled, a very strange contraption kind of shoe. So, and I walked bent over, and I had to put like about a pound of putty and a big fake eyeball on. So I was disfigured like wild and uncomfortable like crazy. And that's probably the hardest thing I ever did, because right in the middle of the show, we had to do what the director called our 5-minute stare at the audience. And he timed 5 minutes that we had to stare at the audience. And it always got the effect he wanted. It was very chilling and very much put the audience on the spot. And other than that, no, the challenge was to get to the theater on time, I guess.
Okay. And what types of activities are you engaged in now? Do you work with any young actors? Do you do any volunteer work with any theater people? I know you do your work at the rehearsal space, but is there any other activities that you're engaged in?
Well, no, not really. What I have done is, there was a festival based on a playwright whose work we did with the Playhouse, and they were presenting two of his pieces, and I talked to the two companies that were mounting the pieces and told them what we had done when we had done it. Not that they incorporated anything I said, but they were surprised that anybody was even around that had done them. So that's kind of the most I do. And I guess like any old codger, I remember the good old days and tell people that, you know, however tough you think it is now, it's nothing compared and dot, dot, dot. So that's the extent of my connection.
And what advice would you give to a young performer?
Know what you're doing and know who you're trying to get to, because it's not what you know, it's who you know. And it's the connections you... I don't know that you have to be kind to everybody, but you have to be able to relate to them in a way that will make you memorable. In a good way. It didn't used to matter if it was a good way or not, but it does now.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm not sure. Are we recording?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know what to say. That's kind of distilled the thought down into very few words.
Okay. Is there anything else that we did not cover that you would like to cover at this point? About a particular show, a particular moment that was important to you?
Gee, you know, nothing comes to mind.
Okay, one more question. You mentioned last time we were together about using drugs and how that affected you. Can you speak a little bit more of that? How did you know that it was more than a problem? You mentioned it had become a problem. How did you know? What was the moment?
Well, when I first started smoking and taking acid and such, there was not the skull and crossbones stamped on the product or the usage, and it was a great deal of fun. After maybe 8 or 10 years of just doing those basic smokables and some acid, mescaline, or what have you, I discovered cocaine and heroin. And I was very careful not to go on stage, high behind those things, but I continued to smoke and go on stage because it only heightened the experience and made it work. I mean, I had done some long-term touring of the show Hair, and to go on stage and be high doing that is a blessing. I mean, the lights, the singing, the dancing, it's a real good time. Well, it became the way I earned my money. I had always dabbled in selling a little pot every now and again, and it turned into something more serious at one point, and then it turned into cocaine and heroin sales. And I had to make up my mind, because of the schedule the sales required and the extracurricular activity of picking up the merchandise, bringing it home, dividing it, and reselling, I had to decide when I was going to stop letting the theater interfere with my drug business. And it was probably 12 years into my career, and I had done a couple of really, really good union shows, and I had SAG and equity union memberships, and I worked and I applied myself to the work. Well, doing all these drugs doesn't make you want to go out and stand in the line auditioning, plus you're in no shape to do so. So I made up my mind at one point I'd have to give the theater up. At one point it was selling the pot to be able to afford to not work a real job and to keep a rehearsal schedule. But also along the same time I did have jobs, many jobs, mostly answering services, answering phones. And I had to let that go, and I decided to do so and replace it with the pot sales, and that worked pretty good. But I let it all consume my life, and like anything addictive and really not very good for you, it did consume my life, and it no longer became fun, and it went from being just a casual fun thing to do to addiction. And I can't tell you when that was, because you don't see it happening. And I wasn't a trained drug addict. I had no schooling in the fine art. I had to learn everything by myself, as it were. And these are not pretty subjects to deal with. And it cost me my career. And I was on the verge of bigger and better. And had I stayed with it instead of the other, I don't know where I would be. I mean, I had a couple of incidents, which I think I related some of to you, about being screwed out of a Broadway show and an off-Broadway show, and I let that bother me probably more than it should. So that's the long and the short of that.
And when you did realize that drugs were an issue, when it was more serious, as you mentioned, can you talk a little bit about that? What was your sort of outlook at that point? Where you were at that point? Can you talk about that?
Well, I was certain that I was in no shape to go back on a stage. Although the last piece I did in front of a real audience, I was really very good. And I went to the theater. It was a little review, and it was very funny. And it was in a very small space in a bar. And I was super well featured in the show. I took I think I took the final curtain call. I was the last one to bow which always points at something. And I went through every performance with a little bottle of cocaine in one pocket of my costume and a little bottle of heroin in the other pocket of my costume. So I'd come off stage and decide which would I do. And oddly enough, nobody, none of my friends, including my best friend, none of them knew how far gone I was. And I was like, I mean, the very idea. I'd come off on an exit and change my costume and be ready, snorting coke off in the wings. It's not a pretty sight. But I got away with it because the show was extended and extended and great reviews. And I had a couple of offers. Someone offered to write me a nightclub act based on what they saw me doing. And I knew better. I knew better than to say yes. And that was really the last time I got on a stage.
It seems like you connected, you made the connection yourself, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you knew enough not to go back on the stage because that was sort of helping you do the drugs, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that connection was there between doing a show. So when you finished doing theater and you didn't get back on a stage, did you then end drugs?
Oh, certainly not. What I knew was earlier, before and at the beginning of my drug use, I stuck to a routine every night of any show I was in where I would physically and emotionally warm up. I'd take my time getting to the theater. I would do at least an hour physical warm up, stretching and just warming up. And take my time putting on my makeup, because with the Playhouse, it was always very detailed makeup. Even the white face and glitter was detailed. And when I did the review that I just described, I was in no kind of shape. I judged my abilities by how healthy I felt to do the warm-up. And I didn't do the warm-up once for this show. So to me, that was a sign of something. I wasn't clear. Well, I wasn't clear to begin with, but I wasn't clear on what that was a sign of. But when it was over, I knew that my drug use was no longer to get high and have fun. It was now to maintain. It was a maintenance thing. And if I didn't use, I'd be sick. So it turned into something totally different.
And can you talk about going through that as far as getting to the other side when you gave up drugs? Just a little bit.
Well, it was a long time between then and when I did give them up. And it was about 15 years before I did. And I really only did because my mother was ailing. I had moved to San Francisco. And of course you take your problems with you. And whatever my intentions were, and they were to get clean and stay clean, it just didn't happen. I went and found everything I needed in a heartbeat. And so my mother got sick and I needed to go tend to her and be by her side. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to keep using while I was there. I mean, I could have gotten away with it. I was alone in her house. But I also hadn't had the money to buy enough to stretch that out. Neither would I have gone out on the street to find it. I had never, ever done that. And I didn't keep the connection in such a way that I could depend on them to send it to me. And I wasn't going to have a handful of money for a while anyway. So my mother passed on, and so did my drug habit.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.